This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
What happens when you let go and start saying yes? Where will it take you? There is beauty and spontaneity in truly living in the here and now. These questions and statement drive Jenny Vanderlinden, a breast cancer survivor and mother of four now battling deadly stage 3 ovarian cancer, every day. Her journey, captured in the documentary film I Heart Jenny, chronicles the ups and downs of her battle and the reality of a woman that, in spite of her adversity, continues to fill her days with adventure, infectious laughter, excitement, and joy. Her story will inspire you to take that leap of faith in your own life and start living life to its fullest. I was so happy to catch a moment in her busy schedule to talk with her about her childhood in White Plains, New York, her educational background and professional training, managing family traumas and transition, how she continues to navigate the challenges presented to her by multiple cancer diagnoses, how social media creates a space for community, honesty, and healing for her along the way, and why it is important to enjoy and embrace every opportunity presented in each moment of this precious life. Jenny, welcome to the AYG List.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
So are you in Colorado right now?
I am in gorgeous Colorado right now.
Is it snowing?
It is not snowing, but I'm up in the mountains, and there is snow on the peaks, and I actually skied yesterday and the day before for a couple hours.
Oh, you're such a rock star. I love that. And I love snow.
So, Jenny, we met at a very unique gathering of Kenyon College graduates who were connected because we all attended the school in the 80s. That weekend was extraordinary and defined by many remarkable moments. But for me, the most powerful of them all was when you shared that you had a film crew following you all weekend because you were documenting your very personal fight with cancer at our Moss-style story presentation. As you recall, it reduced me to a flood of tears, and I believe that the first time I actually interacted with you that weekend was when you finished sharing your story and a bunch of us got up and showered you with hugs and kisses.
Yes.
And what felt like an ocean of tears, I was like, oh, my gosh, I may never stop crying. But then on our last night there, you pulled me away from this impossibly hot man and asked me to dance.
Did I really? Wow.
Yeah, you did. He was hot.
I apologize. I'm losing my cred. My goodness. Did I send you right back to him afterwards?
You actually abandoned me, and then you apologized later by offering me a Snicker bar.
Ooh, Snicker bar for man. I don't know if that was an even trade.
It was funny. It was just, you know, one of those Kenyan things. But anyway, that was a really great experience, and it moved so many of us. And I knew that as soon as I was given the opportunity to host this show that I wanted you to be a guest. So I am so grateful that you are here today, and I'm so happy to have this conversation with you so that we can share your life and your light with so many others. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I feel very honored and don't quite feel like I live up to some of the legendary guests you've had on so far, but happy to share my story. Happy to share
Well, you are a legend in your own time, and we're going to share with our audience why. Before we get into great detail about your own battle with two types of cancers, I want to know about your life before cancer. You were born in White Plains, New York, to European parents, the youngest of three and the only girl. What was that like?
When you have European parents and European grandparents and you're the only girl, there is this sort of sense of, shh, we'd rather you were a little more seen than heard, and that's really not my forte.
I know.
So I was a bit lonely. It was a little tough. We grew up on a windy street, and I went to an elementary school that was, I love the fact that I am one of the few people of my generation that can tell my kids, I walked over a mile and three-tenths each way to school every morning. There was actually a bus that took us to elementary school, but you had to pay for the bus, and my parents felt there was no good reason why I couldn't walk through rain, through snow, through sleet, through hail.
Right. Well, where were they from in Europe?
My mother was British. She grew up in London. And my father was French, and he grew up in France.
Ah. So
they both grew up, well, they both grew up during World War II. And it's a whole other very interesting story about how they left Europe and hid their Jewishness because of their fear of Hitler. In fact, I didn't know that I had a Jewish history until I was about 14 years old when my parents told
me. Really?
Yeah,
how did that impact you?
Well, it was interesting because that elementary school that I went to was highly Jewish, and I remember when, and I never cared about race or color. You know, you're a kid, and my parents were very open to everybody, so I didn't think much about it, but I do remember being on the playground one day, and it's a strange experience for a 10-year-old white girl in, you know, New York to be ostracized, pushed to the side with two other kids because I was not Jewish. It was a highly Jewish bunch of kids, and for whatever reason, and I still remember that. And, you know, one of those life experiences that's probably good for all of us to have, to be a minority once in a while. Mm-hmm. But I remember when I was 14 and my parents told me, immediately thinking, damn it, I would have told them, I'm Jewish, don't push me away. Because we don't really understand what that's all about at that age.
Right. You clearly have good taste in college because
I
chose Kenyon. And then you went to Catholic University. Tell me what your life is like at Kenyon and Catholic.
I went to Kenyon. My eldest brother, Chris, also went to Kenyon. He graduated in 1977. Not a lot of us had heard of Kenyon at this time, but we had a family relative who was a college professor somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he recommended Kenyon as being a high-level academic institution. I'm a smart girl, but I wouldn't say that I worked extremely hard in high school, so my grades were okay. And at the time, Kenyon was a great choice. Now I'm pretty sure I couldn't get into Kenyon.
We all say that.
I worked at College Fair once for Kenyon long, long time ago, and all these bright, ambitious people came up to sign out the little cards, and they fill out their GPA and their what they do, and I'm reading these things, 4.1, 4.2, 3.9. I'm like, wow, you'll be great for Kenyon, all the while I'm thinking, oh, my, I would never get in.
Right.
But Kenyon was a great experience. I was a psychology major. I met and fell in love with my future husband when I was at Kenyon, when I was a freshman and he was a sophomore. Mm-hmm. And then what was interesting is I was a psych major and I ended up overseas in Scotland. And Kenyon wasn't real supportive of going to Great Britain without doing the Exeter program.
Right,
and at that time, I had been trying to decide whether I'd be an English major or a psych major. So that helped me decide on psych. And then my senior year of high school, I went to Philadelphia and did the Urban Semester program, which is an amazing experience because you work 32 hours a week in your chosen field, in your chosen profession.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for a partial hospitalization program outside of Philadelphia and ran groups and worked with chronically mentally ill who had been discharged from hospitals and needed a gap between the two environments.
Uh-huh.
And what was interesting is I looked around and I liked what I was doing, so I asked the other professionals what kind of degrees they had, because at Kenyon, all you really thought about was going on to get a PhD in your field or a master's degree. No one mentioned social work and MSW as an option. So long story short, I decided to apply to social work school, and I went to Catholic University. It was a great experience with varying different jobs, working with chronically mentally ill, but then working with folks. I had the wonderful luxury of working in the Catholic University Counseling Center. And I got to counsel other college students, and I loved it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you were a trained social worker, but then you became a certified aerobics instructor. A certified personal trainer.
Wait, I'm not even finished.
A certified personal trainer, a certified professional ski instructor. I mean, it's like, what? I mean, you have to be pretty fit and badass to be successful in those fields. So I'm like, how in the world did this all come about? So there was the social work, and then you just got, did you just get this, I want to be Was it Jane Fonda? Like, I don't understand. Where did it come from?
It's funny you mentioned Jane Fonda. I remember doing Jane Fonda in my dorm room with my friends at Kenyon.
Oh, that's hilarious.
No, what happened was I worked pretty hard to make my way into my dream job in Washington. And unfortunately, in November of 1989, I got a phone call from my father saying it was a Saturday before Thanksgiving. It's one of those moments where you know exactly where you were.
Right.
And he told me that my mother was just diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is my husband and I basically packed up at the speed of light. I remember seeing a old picture with a for sale sign in the window of our condo that we'd only just had a year and a half behind a Christmas tree. We only found out at Thanksgiving she was ill, and by Christmas our house was on the market.
Right.
I moved to New York, to Connecticut, to be closer to my mom. My mom lived in New York. My husband's parents lived in Jersey, and Connecticut was our compromise.
Right.
And
right.
I took another social work job while I was up there, not one that I loved, but it was a bird in hand. And I was also going through infertility treatment.
Mm.
So what happened was my mom was fighting her cancer. I wanted to be available to her. I was going through infertility treatment, which is quite time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a part-time job. So when I got pregnant with twins, I, up at about 30 weeks, went into preterm labor and quit my social work job and was a stay-at-home mom for two beautiful boy-girl twins. And that was my life for the next 2 years. Then I got pregnant with another set of twins. Yeah, and my parents very generously offered to pay for a nanny for the first 2 years.
Wow.
And I was smart enough, yes, it saved my life. I had four children under 3 years old for a month.
Ooh.
Which was, yeah, four car seats, four in diapers.
Right.
Crazy, crazy. But I knew that if I was going to, I've always been athletic, I've always been involved in sports, I've always loved to be outside. I knew that if I was going to be able to keep up with four small kids, I better be in the best shape I can.
Mm-hmm.
So with the luxury of having a built-in babysitter, I went to the gym every day. About a year later, the aerobics instructor said to me, "Hey, Jenny, have you thought of teaching?" And I laughed. I was like, "Yeah, no, no." And she said, "Well, I think you'd be good at it. You have very good form. I think you have the right personality for it." And I figured out that if I got certified to teach aerobics, I would get paid to exercise, and then I could pay for my babysitter because my nanny funding was running out.
Right.
So that's what happened. I taught aerobics, and then to do continuing education, I became a personal trainer. We've been a ski family for a long time, and we used to drive up to Vermont from Connecticut every Friday night to Okemo Mountain.
Wow.
And I became a ski instructor because that was going to help pay for us to all have ski passes. And I wanted to keep getting better. Coming from Kenyon, you learn to love to learn. So
yeah.
Whatever my field was, whether it was social work, and I went on to do postgraduate work and family training, or aerobics or ski instructor, I've always tried to educate myself very well in each of my fields. I like to be good at what I do.
Yeah.
So that's how that all came to be. Well, the best part is the social work background, the psychology background, really gives wonderful skill set to being a good ski instructor, to being a good personal trainer, to helping to connect to people and helping them find joy in what they're trying to do.
You married a Kenyan man.
I did.
You have four children and two sets of twins. What has being a wife and a mother taught you?
What has been, well, it's clearly one of the hardest jobs that you can do if you want to do it well. But one of the things that I've, and I was never a self-help book kind of girl. I was never one that read. I have a lot of common sense, and I have good instincts, and I learned fairly early to trust those.
Mm-hmm.
And you worry about your kids, obviously. You want them to turn out well, and you read stories and horror stories. And the bottom line, what it boiled down to me was, love your children consistently. If your children know that they're loved and safe, the rest will work itself out.
Mm-hmm. And being a wife.
Being a wife. Michael and I are separated now. We sort of intended to get divorced, but we never got around to it. We really, my feeling was, unless one of us was in a serious relationship, it didn't really matter.
Hmm.
It's interesting because we tried some therapy, and one of the things that I learned as a wife is, I'm not as right as I think I am.
Especially
I mean,
the 10
I'm so clear that I'm right most of the time until you have a third person, objective person sort of holding the mirror up and you go, oh. It's right. It's a lot of compromise, and what's most important to a successful marriage and our more successful years, it's communication. Communication and openness. And I think our biggest difficulty was the fact we met when I was 18 and Michael was 19 years old. We met very young, and we never particularly matured in the way we interacted. We were both very stubborn and strong-minded, and so we didn't come to it with the adult knowledge of there's compromise, you can't always have your own way. So it's tough when you meet that young, but it's also so wonderful because we're very good friends. I even took him on vacation with the kids last year. We share so much family history. He has known me since I was a teenager.
You talked about how you guys made the decision once you got the call, when you found out that your mom was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 89. You moved to Connecticut to be closer to her. Tell me a little bit more about how you and your family dealt with her struggle.
Your mother is invincible until something, and immortal. Until something happens, that's how most of us our parents. At least that's the luxury that I had in how I saw my mom. It felt like the carpet was pulled out from under me. I couldn't believe that my mother could put, my mother was never sick. So when she gets on the phone and tells me, well, Gilda Radner lived 3 years, my brain is spinning trying to figure out what do you mean 3 years?
Yeah.
I've always been someone that lived in the present, that thought that today was important. Michael and I, because all of our family was in the Northeast, it was something we had considered doing. We wanted to be back up in the Northeast when we started a family, and we just started trying. So the decision to go, we made it quickly, but it was helpful that we had always intended to go.
Right.
It was important to me to be there for my mother, to be there when she had surgeries, to be there to support her during her chemotherapy. There's not family is very important to me. It's very important to Michael. One of the things that made us very good parents was the fact, well, in our opinion, of course. One of the things that made it easier for us to parent was the fact that we have very similar upbringings and similar morals and values, and family is right at the top of the list. So it was wonderful to be up there, and luckily my mother went into a long remission shortly after we moved there, and I got pregnant with twins, and it was wonderful because we got to raise our children with my parents, most of my brothers, their cousins. Mm-hmm. They spent weekends swimming in my parents' swimming pool. They have wonderful, wonderful memories of that time.
So then, unfortunately, in 2004, you were diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer and did 6 months of chemotherapy. And then in 2005, you learned that you had the BRCA1 mutation and had a double mastectomy, breast reconstruction, and a hysterectomy. How in the world did you process that and share the information with your loved ones and make decisions about treatment?
When I found out that we found a lump, and when we found out that the lump, and everyone told us 99% chance it's nothing, and it wasn't until I was being wheeled into the operating room, and I think one of the interns says, 89% chance it's nothing. And I thought, whoa. How did I just lose 10%?
Mm-hmm.
But when I came out from surgery, we found out that it was cancer. One of my best friends was my children's pediatrician, and the wonderful thing about my relationship with Nancy is the fact that we think very similarly, and I highly recommend having a friend, a close friend, who has the same thought processes, because what's very helpful is when you're under stress, when you don't feel like you can make easy decisions, I turn to Nancy, and she can tell me what I would do if my thoughts were clearer, and I can do the same for her. So I talked to Nancy, and I was trying to figure out, am I telling my children right now? They were, I think, 6 and 9 years old. They were young. But I don't believe in secrets. I think secrets do an incredible amount of damage, and the couple of weeks leading up to the actual surgery where you're having tests and different, you know, you're sneaking out onto the deck to talk on the phone away from the kids. Kids are smart. They know something's up. So with Nancy's encouragement, she met us at the house, and we told our children the next day, or possibly the same day, that I had breast cancer. And my daughter, Jessie, to this day is mortified by this, but she looked at me and said, oh, okay, can I share that in school tomorrow? It's my turn to share.
Wow.
And I just sort of looked at her, and that was the first moment of, you need to make a decision about how open you really can be about this.
Yeah.
And I looked at her, and I said, I told her yes. I didn't want to, but I told her yes because I thought that was the smartest thing to do, and I didn't want her to think it was some big, scary secret. But what I said to her was, I said, Jesse, please come home and tell me what your friends say, and because I don't want anyone to scare you. Because I was afraid that someone else might say, oh, my God, your mom has cancer. My grandmother died of cancer.
Right.
So from the very, very get-go, my cancer was a pretty public conversation.
And so it's also interesting that you had someone who was in the medical field that was a friend and a confidant that helped you process all of that.
I am incredibly fortunate.
Yeah.
My brother is a doctor. My mother should have been a doctor. I seem to always have several friends that are in the medical field at the same time, which is great.
As your kids got older and as this progressed for you and for them and they were a part of this process, I mean, how did they kind of manage mommy is ill and mommy is in treatment? What was that like for them?
Well, there's an amusing part to it. When you get bad news like this, typically your friends and family and neighborhood convene together and they cook.
Yeah.
I never cooked much. My mom was a great cook. My brother's a great cook. My kids love the fact that Johnson's chicken wings, someone else brought, I mean, they loved the fact that food kept showing up.
Right.
And so that part of it was kind of fun for them.
Mm-hmm.
When I was trying to decide, we found the lump. I had the excisional biopsy, the lumpectomy, clear margins, essentially no lymph node involvement. Essentially, I was likely to be clear of cancer. My oncologist recommended chemotherapy, but he told me there were two different ones that he recommended but thought that I should choose between them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little confused and said, well, why do you think I should choose? And he said, I think if you saw 10 oncologists, 5 would say do ACT and 5 would say do CMF. And I'm one, the ACT, quite harsh, lose your hair, quite debilitating, really knocks you out.
Mm-hmm.
And the CMF, much more tolerable. And I had to hem and haw for quite a while to try to figure it out. And I remember I went to go see a therapist to help me make that decision. And I was talking to him, and I had long, long, thick hair was sort of my thing.
Yeah, I saw.
And we're talking about it, and I said to him, you know, I feel like a jerk, but I don't want to lose my hair.
Right.
And he looked at me and he said, you'd be crazy if that wasn't one of the considerations. You have beautiful hair. And he made it so normal that I talked about the fact that I was considering doing the chemotherapy that wasn't as harsh. And as I thought about it, I felt this weight lifting off my shoulders. And he said, I think you've made your decision. And the bottom line was, I realized that I believe that I am my greatest resource. I tend to have an optimistic, happy attitude. And I felt that if I did the harsher chemotherapy, which might not have even been necessary, lost my hair, wasn't able to work as a personal trainer, struggled to be mom, that it was going to be harder to stay in touch with Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
And that if I did the other chemotherapy, I could continue to live my life much more closely to how I'd been living it. I even continued to teach skiing that winter.
Yeah.
So my kids are an incredible reflection. People ask now, because now things are obviously much more serious, and people often ask me, how are your kids doing? And what I always say is, they're a great reflection of how I'm doing. If I'm doing well, they do well. And I've been able to be fairly strong through both the cancer treatment and the more recent situation.
In the midst of all of this, two major events occurred. Your father committed suicide, and you were separated from your husband. How did that affect your health and your healing and your emotional state?
Let's see. What happened first? My father never got it. My father's a very strong, strong man. He was a patriarch to three families. He's walked four women down the aisle, and I'm the only daughter. He took care of everybody. But he never got over losing my mom, and he was dealing with some health problems himself, and he was depressed and didn't sleep well. And always worry about your friends who are depressed and not sleeping well. It's a tragic combination. And I spent a lot of time with my dad, but ultimately he took his own life on Labor Day. And it was beyond devastating. There's really no words for it, having already lost my mother, to lose my father as well. Both my brothers were all in the same area, and so we were able to band together and support each other. But while my father was ill, he and I had talked about possibly moving to California together, and somewhere I've always wanted to live. And I don't know, he didn't shoot it down as an idea. I don't know if he was serious about it or whether he knew that he was going to take his own life and it wasn't going to be an issue, but it was something that I looked into over the summer months. And when he died, I found that I still wanted to go, that there had been so much loss for me on the East Coast. I'd lost my mother, I'd gotten cancer, I'd lost my breasts, I had the hysterectomy, my marriage had been ending over several years, and now my father was dead also. I really felt like I needed a fresh start. And I often believe when one door closes, another door opens. And because both of my parents were gone, and I inherited some money from my parents, I had the financial freedom to make a fresh start. And it was sort of, I think I was really just moving in survival mode, but intelligent survival mode. I researched the best schools because Jesse and Lexi, my two youngest, were about to start high school. And my husband and I were not happy with the high school they were going to be feeding into. It had gone downhill since my eldest two. And we chose Boulder, Colorado, and Michael was very supportive of me moving. So I moved to Boulder with Jesse and Lexi to start at Fairview High School, top high school. And my eldest two stayed in Connecticut to finish their senior year of high school, which was understandably hard to leave them, but luckily there's great airports, and I went home many, many, many times to see major accomplishments that happened that year.
So is it fair to say that in a way Colorado kind of saved you a little?
Colorado went skiing, strangely enough. When right after my dad died in Labor Day, I was teaching up at Okemo, and I channeled my grief into ski training. The way I thought about it was, well, I like educating myself and doing things well. And within any field, you can educate and learn more. And there's different certification levels. So I went to, I accomplished two certifications that year. One was my level two certification. The other was a master's teacher certification. I'm told it takes 2 to 5 years. And I pulled it off in one season. But I felt like when I was on a ski mountain, it was always a good day. I didn't miss my father on a mountain because he wasn't a skier. So skiing kind of saved me. And then making the decision on where to move, I chose Colorado instead of California because of the skiing and because my daughter was an extremely talented ski racer. So the fresh coming to Colorado, I don't know that I needed Colorado to save me, but it certainly started a very joyful next stage of my life. It's a wonderful, wonderful state.
You've had all of these major, 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 major life events, and you're in Colorado, and things are going along, and then something happens, and it occurs to you that you need to investigate the possible return of this cancer. Can you explain that process and how it came about? Like how it occurred to you.
I'll absolutely tell you about that, but since you listed some of the tragedies, it will be hard for me to skip over the fact that we moved to Colorado in August. Jesse and Lexi started high school. Lexi started with an elite ski race team.
Wow.
And in January of that year, so I moved to Colorado. My eldest son looked into the University of Colorado, and I Googled Boulder, and the first thing I read was over 300 days of sun a year. I had a visceral reaction. I was like, wait, what? I want that. So we came to Colorado. Lexi is training with an elite ski team. And on January 7th, the day before her 15th birthday, I didn't know anybody in Colorado. This was a complete leap of faith. Lexi crashes at the bottom of a race course and breaks both of her legs.
No.
Lexi breaks both of her legs at the bottom of a downhill race course. My daughter is now in a wheelchair. So I got to the point where I was afraid for the phone to ring because much bad news kept coming over the phone. My father's death, my mother's cancer, my being BRCA positive when I found out about after my cancer, Lexi's broken legs. So moving ahead, we got through that. And to Lexi's incredible credit, she is an incredible ski racer still, and she's in the hunt for trying to get onto the University of Colorado's D1 race team. And she's a phenomenal skier and back at it. Let's see. April of 2011, I guess the sirens kind of went off in my head. I hadn't been feeling well all winter. But what's interesting about the symptoms of ovarian cancer is how easily they can be misinterpreted as something else. My symptoms were I had a distended belly, my bowel movements changed, I was gassy, I had difficulty digesting things. Perhaps I was tired, but I was also skiing a lot, so it's hard mm-hmm. to know if you're more tired
right.
if you're actually able to be out there skiing mm-hmm. hard. I think there were two moments when I realized something's really wrong. We had friends over for dinner, and I made dinner, just a lasagna and some salad. And I'm a picker, and I put the meal out, and I realized I hadn't taken a single carrot out of the salad or piece of noodle from the lasagna, and I didn't eat anything. And I had been noticing that my hips were getting smaller, but my belly was getting bigger. And then I looked in the mirror one night, and I looked at my belly, and I saw my belly button starting to push out, like when I was 8 months pregnant. Something was wrong. So I made the phone calls, and this is one of the important messages that I want people to hear. If you know something is wrong and you try to make doctor's appointments and there's no room for you, take the appointment. Take any appointment you can get, and then you push to get in earlier. The first appointment I could get was 10 days later. And although I have been trying cleanses and taking gluten out of my diet, no dairy, no wheat, tried every version of what was trying to figure out what was wrong with my digestive issues, I finally realized something might be wrong. And the first appointment they could give me was 10 days later, which once I make a decision, I like to act upon it quickly. So what I did was on the following Monday, I called back and said, when can I get in sooner? And they said, how about tomorrow? There was a cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the doctor. They did the preliminary. We did a stool sample kit, and I went home with scheduled endoscopy, colonoscopies, and some other test was scheduled. Unfortunately, about 3 days later, I spiked a high fever, and I remember calling the after-hours doctor and told her about it's been several months, I had a distended belly, I had a high fever, and she said, I don't like this collection of symptoms, come to the ER.
Wow.
So my friend Erica, who's a physician's assistant, I always have somebody medical in my world, drove me to the ER, and we sat in the ER for 3 hours waiting to be seen, doing differential diagnosis. You know, could it be Crohn's disease? Could it be diverticulitis? I'm sitting there going, go Giardia.
Right.
You know, it's like, let it be something that could be fixed easily. In the hospital several hours, at this point, my friends left, and my daughter, Courtney, came to the hospital. She was in the middle of finals at CU, or midterms, and actually finals. And the doctor came into our room at 1 o'clock in the morning, and she was a young woman with kind of cool, funky hair, someone, you know, you'd think you might be friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, your blood test looks okay, but the CAT scan shows that you have ascites. And I'm thinking, ascites? I don't know what that is. And she says, that's fluid from cancer cells, most likely ovarian cancer cells. And I had a full hysterectomy. I did the prophylactic hysterectomy so that this couldn't happen. Unfortunately, there's still a 1 to 4% chance that it can happen because of leftover ovarian cells in your abdominal cavity. The doctor came in and told me this. I turned and looked at my daughter, Courtney. And, April, I could feel this bubble of disbelief over my head. I couldn't believe what she just said. And I turned to Courtney and I said, am I dreaming? And she said, right. I don't think so, Mama. And I looked at the doctor and I said, you need to go out and come back and say something different.
Yeah.
It was devastating. It didn't make any sense, and it seemed completely unfair.
1 to 4%. And it's
1 to 4%.
Just hard to get your head around.
Absolutely, and this was stage 3 metastatic.
All right.
Technically called primary peritoneal cancer because I don't have ovaries.
Right. And so you began the treatment that you're dealing with today. So tell me about that treatment and how you're managing that treatment now.
The first line of treatment, typically when a woman is diagnosed with ovarian cancer, the first thing that happens is she has a full hysterectomy to debulk, per se, the tumor. Often with ovarian cancer, there isn't necessarily a large tumor, but they do exploratory laparotomy, and they take out and see what they take. They do a hysterectomy. I did not need that surgery because I didn't have any ovaries left. So the first course of treatment was a fairly harsh chemotherapy, Taxol, and something else. But Taxol was the big culprit that made me quite sick. I was still sporting long, thick, pretty hair. It was kind of my thing. And 3 weeks after treatment, I was told I would lose my hair. So in about 2 weeks, a friend of mine shaved my head for me. Mm. What was kind of cool is that my daughter, Jessica, is an incredible photographer. And I guess through much of this, whether it's the breast cancer or the ovarian cancer, I sort of sucked up my pride for what I felt was the greater good. And Jessie came down and took photographs while my head was being shaved. Because I looked at her and I said, you have this amazing opportunity. There's going to be other photographers, photojournalists that would kill for the chance for this type of experience. And so I right then gave Jessie permission to take photos of me in any state that she wanted through this whole journey.
How's she been processing that? Like when you invited her to do that, was she reluctant or did she kind of say, this is a real opportunity and this is my mom?
I think it was a mixed bag for her. I think she wasn't quite sure. Her twin sister, I was convinced, would not come and watch. We went down to the basement where there's a tile floor. I was pretty sure that she wouldn't. And instead, she came down. I had two friends there. We put some music on. We kind of made it an empowering celebration. It was, and then we actually took photos. I let her take photos of my bald head, but also with no shirt on because I have mastectomy scars and reconstruction scars, and I thought that these might be photographs that should be seen someday. So I did that chemotherapy for the recommended course was 6 sessions every 3 weeks. Unfortunately, at 5 weeks, I had an allergic reaction. I was having trouble breathing, basically, and we stopped. I was actually put in the ICU. It was another little dramatic. There's been a lot of these little dramatic, go to the hospital, over to the ICU. Actually, it's a funny story. I went to the Rocky Mountain Cancer Center, which is a wonderful group of people, and Jenny Fox is my doctor there, and I couldn't be luckier. And I was having trouble catching my breath, so one of the nurses decided to hook me up to a device that measures your oxygenation in your blood. And I went for a walk with this device on my finger. Typically, we should be in the high 90 percentile. My oxygenation dropped to 52%. And they looked at me and went, okay, you're going to the hospital. You're actually going to ICU. And they wanted to, they took me over in a wheelchair. They wanted to take me over in an ambulance. We're talking, it was across the parking lot. So my joke was, why not flight for life off the roof of the building? But we actually had a similar incident a few weeks ago when I had sort of a strange reaction to what's going on. It's been a crazy course. After that, I had my first exploratory surgery in September. There's a blood test called a CA125, which when my mother had cancer 20 years ago, they believed was the gold test for measuring ovarian cancer cells. Mm-hmm. We now know it's not a very good test. Typically, if your number is 30 and below, you're in remission. When I was diagnosed, I was about 150. People can be 1,500. It's not been a good measure for me. But when I finished that first course of treatment and went to have the exploratory surgery, my number was down to 6. And I knew they saw a little something on the CAT scan, but I figured this will be okay. My cancer has been so similar to my mother's. It's responded so similarly. And my mother went into remission for 2.5 years. So I met with the surgeon before the surgery, and I asked him, I said, what percentage of people go into remission after this first course? And he says, 80%. And I was like, okay, I guess I won't be so special. When I came out of that surgery, unfortunately, they found several small tumors. They found what they called cancer sands, cancer that was too small to even burn off, and other things that they could take out. And it was clear that I was not in remission.
You know, it's interesting to me because you've been processing much of this publicly and on social media. As a matter of fact, this interview I wanted to do, but you kind of sparked me because I guess it was a couple of weeks ago. You posted something on Facebook about you having a challenging period. There are lots of people who love you for good reason, I being one of them.
I feel very, very loved.
It's interesting to me how, one, you are so optimistic in the face of this. I mean, you have always described yourself as a glass half full kind of person. And people say that, but when you live with something as daunting as your prognosis and what's happening with you right now, there's a lived experience of that. And a part of that lived experience is also being honest when you are upset or going through a moment And you call for the strength of the people who love you in the most profound and powerful way. And I actually believe that, you know, this is the way we should be using social media in ways that are generative, and you do that so beautifully. And you shared with me some of the things that you put in the past, and there were a couple of them that kind of struck me. I mean, many of them are so thoughtful and deeply meaningful, and then you say things that I believe will help other people. One of the things you said was, when you have cancer, you should have a king-size bed so that there's room for kids and friends and pets to hang out. And you also said that being without a significant other is not a bad thing if you are well-loved by family and friends. There's no gatekeeper or obstacle to friends coming and staying and hanging as long as you both want. And you also talked about having money in the bank and how it makes the bucket list planning for remission a lot more fun. Tell me how this has kind of helped you and how it's been received by others.
What's been kind of crazy is the fact that I feel so fortunate. I mean, I can still say that, even though it really looks like I'm losing this battle. I feel so incredibly fortunate because I feel well-loved. I feel well-supported. And it turns out that my personality of being open to people has allowed people to come in to support me. Social media, Facebook has been incredible. My kids still give me a hard time. For a long time, they were like, oh, you're too old to have Facebook. So I didn't have an account for years. And I agree with you. I think it's exactly how Facebook should be used. And that story I was telling you about getting sent into ICU mm-hmm. unexpectedly because my oxygenation was so critically low, I, for some reason, didn't have my phone with me. And I was immediately sent someone back to the house to get my phone. And I said, I need to post on Facebook. Like, Mom, you're being ridiculous. I said, you don't understand. Every time I've posted on Facebook, when something bad has happened, when something has taken a turn for the worse, magically things have gotten better so quickly. People quickly write and support me. And it's become amazing. You mentioned this most recent occurrence. Yes. I recently found out that the fourth chemo I'm on, so I've been through four different types of chemotherapy. This most recent one appears to no longer be working, and now we're trying to get access to an experimental drug on a compassionate use basis. So the proverbial, you know what, has hit the fan. This is not mm-hmm. a great place to be in. And I was having an incredibly low moment, and I posted on Facebook what was going on. I have a lot of people that have been following, and it blew me away, and a lot of it started from Kenyan. Over 150 people changed their profile picture to an I Heart Jenny sticker, which has been sort of the icon a friend made for me when I was first diagnosed to support me, and these stickers have been sent all over the world and been pictured everywhere, and I can't even explain to you, that night as I was going to sleep and was in a pretty dark place, I wasn't in a dark place because I could not believe the support that I had gotten. And the other part that has been amazing to me is that my openness and willingness to express my struggles and my strengths, I try very hard. I was able to go skiing yesterday, and when I've been having a bad day, I try very hard to put the good stuff on Facebook as well because I know that there are people out there rooting for me and sad for me on certain days. And I want them to know when I'm having a good day as well.
Right. That's
and
right.
It's been incredible. The feedback has been amazing that people are making decisions and living their lives differently and realizing that just because you hit a roadblock, it doesn't mean everything has to be bad. In the Chinese language, I learned this in graduate school and I've lived it and believed it and shared it many times. In the Chinese language, the word for crisis is made up of two Chinese characters, the character for danger and the character for opportunity.
Yes.
And I completely believe that's true.
Okay, so I'm trying not to sniffle all up in my mic.
I'm not even sure if I answered your question.
you knocked it out of the park. Okay. So tell me how this I Heart Jenny documentary came about.
The I Heart Jenny documentary has been phenomenal. And honestly, April, I feel like any moment Ashton Kutcher is going to jump out and go, you're being punked. We're not making a movie about you. And then my only response is going to be, wait, is a cancer a joke too? Because I can handle that I've been dealing with this, but can I just go on now, please?
Yeah.
The I Heart Jenny. So what happened was my very good friend Sam made me the sticker when I was first diagnosed as support and made 500 stickers and started to tag them all over the towns we live in and sending them to people to, because a lot of our friends travel. They're ski instructors or raft guides. And so people have been taking these stickers to all over the world. It's incredible. And then we asked people to post them on Facebook when they put the sticker somewhere. It was about, I don't know, maybe a year later, 6 months later, and Blake Babbitt, twin brother of my very good friend Ben Babbitt, who was my daughter Lexi's ski race coach, he works for the New York Film Academy, and he moved to New York to be an actor, but has gotten into more production. And in an attempt to learn more about his craft, and because he can also take free courses where he works, he was taking a production class. He wrote me a text one night and said, I'm taking this production class and I have to pitch a movie idea of something I actually want to make. I've been racking my brain and I went on Facebook and I saw all these stickers and I thought, that's it. I want to make the movie about you. 2 days later, he pitched the movie to his instructor who said, you have to actually make this movie. You have to make this movie. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. We did a fundraising, an Indiegogo fundraising campaign, and it's taken off from there, and it's been phenomenal. It's been so much fun and so inspiring, and to me and to others. You mentioned that first time we met was when you heard me talk at the Moth Lectures. That was the very first time I had ever stood up in public and talked about this, and I wasn't even planning on doing it at that moment. But Kenyon's such a warm and loving environment, and I felt so well received. And since that time, we've been filming in Colorado, and we've been filming at Kenyon. We came and filmed. We filmed in lots of places. And now what's really phenomenal is we are doing some public, I've been doing some public talking, raising awareness about ovarian cancer and BRCA. And this is what, you know, most people know about Angelina Jolie, and that she had a double mastectomy because she was positive. And honestly, I knew that her mother had died of ovarian cancer, and I had thought and said out loud a couple of times, man, we need Angelina Jolie as part of this fight. So I was so thankful when she came out publicly about that. So it's been such an honor. We've spoken to film societies, and I met with a rabbi for a synagogue. Typically, BRCA is a Ashkenazi Jewish-related disease because of a lot of the small community that the people married, lived, and procreated in, this mutation occurred. And typically, I think it's 1 in 40 Ashkenazi Jews have this mutation. And if you have this mutation, your chances of ovarian if you have this mutation, your chances of breast cancer are in the 80th percentile and ovarian cancer in the 40 to 60th percentile. So it's a problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem. I want to go back to the land of where you live now. I love that you love all of us enough to share this journey with us. I'm so grateful that this platform exists so that we will never in the history of humankind ever again not have access to your voice. It's so important.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, I'm losing it, but that's okay.
Well, that was one of the first things I said to Blake, and I said, see, I'm going to talk so you can catch up. I was so sad. The very, very first time I went to, he lives in Brooklyn, I went to Brooklyn, and he just put a camera out, and it was very rough. And I said, you know, as soon as we started filming, I said, I'm so thankful because whether or not this ever becomes a movie, there's now recordings of me for my children. You know, I don't have that of my parents, and it is a pretty wonderful thing to be able to have that. And pretty quickly in the filming, I said to Blake, I was texting with him, we filmed a couple of times, I said, Blake, can we please, I have this idea, because, you know, we're messing up all the time, and the cameras are always rolling. I said, after you air the documentary, because I don't actually expect to be alive when this documentary is done and when it's shown at film festivals. I hope so, but I don't have that expectation. I said, when you air the documentary, just as it ends, you know, everybody's going to have like mixed feelings because it'll be inspiring, but it'll be sad. Can then you start running the outtakes, the blooper reel? And he promised me he'll do that because that to me would be perfect. And I said to him the other day, if nothing else, Blake, I said, I don't know how often my kids are going to watch the documentary. I said, just cut them a blooper reel and that'll be enough.
Yeah. I remember reading in the email you sent me yesterday how Blake sent you a text after the first weekend of filming where he said, no, I saw the depths of you and I hadn't seen that before, and I really, truly, honestly realized for the first time that you're going to rip my heart out. Yeah. And I thought about that and, you know, I immediately lost it. And then I thought about you at Kenyon and how much light there was. And I thought about you hula hooping at Kenyon, and I thought about you dancing around, and I thought about the Snicker bar, and I thought, regardless to how any of us go out in this world, we have the opportunity to spread light while we're here.
Absolutely.
And I think if you have given me and the other people who know you and hopefully my audience through this interview nothing else, you have shared that light. So, you know, I'm a big old black Christian with lots of Jewish friends. I've been to a lot of Seders over the past couple of years. And one of the great loves of my life is a Kenyan Sayu, who's a wonderful Jewish man from Cleveland. But I will say this. Spiritually, I don't believe you're ever going to leave us. And part of the reason I don't believe that you're ever going to leave us is because you're so intentional about sharing your story very honestly and very powerfully, but with so much joy. I cannot, there are no words. I mean, I usually wrap these interviews up with like this thing that I think about all the wonderful people that I'm bringing on, because all of you so far have been personal friends. I don't have any words because I feel like this story isn't over yet. And I just want to invite everybody listening to this to follow you, to, you know, join our iHeartJenny on Facebook and follow you on Twitter and to support this project, but to also open themselves up to understanding cancer in all of its forms and how we can open ourselves up to be supportive of our friends and family members who are dealing with this in ways that we may not have thought about. I think part of the power of this particular conversation is you as someone who is living this experience, talking about how it makes you feel, but also the things that are happening around you and the energy that's happening around you that help you continue to carry on. So I am so grateful that on this day you are able to share that story with us, that story that is your actual lived experience, that is your life. And I am sure that everyone who loves you and your kids have to be so proud of you.
It's been, thank you. It's been an amazing, amazing experience. And that's part of the message that I want people to hear is, number one, live in the moment. Because if it's a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise, it's a beautiful sunset, a beautiful sunrise. Yeah. That moment is happening. You don't have to worry about your bills, your fight with your boss, your cancer. Yeah. Enjoy that moment. But I also think that it's incredibly important to allow yourself to be vulnerable so that you can allow your community to fill in those spaces. It helps people to let them give to you, and you have to allow yourself to let that happen. I've always toughed it out and been strong. I'm the youngest kid, the only girl, tough as my brothers. I want to go to Boy Scout camp. But I've learned through having twins and needing help, through my diseases, through loss, it's important to let other people know when you need help, and it's very important to let them. It's a gift to yourself, and it's a gift to your community.
Well, I'm going to close us out with this quote that you sent me that you posted on Facebook, and you said, "Don't forget that we need to keep our eyes wide open so that we never miss a sunset or a sunrise or the beauty of the day or the love being offered to us. Eyes open, chin lifted, to take it all in and look to the future where happiness awaits us all." I love you, Jenny. Thank you so much for sharing your life with me and my audience. And every day you're at the top of my prayer list, and I'm always hugging and kissing your face. I love you. Thank you.
I love you, too. Thank you, April. It really has been a joy to meet you, and you are an incredible light, and I know you're going to have an amazing career. Thank you for including me on your show. Oh, it's been an honor to be here.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday and Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at The AYG List. Also visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thanks for listening. Thank you.